This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, it's the big Memorial Day weekend spectacular. We've got X-Men Apocalypse, we got Alice Through the Looking Glass, we've got The Ones Below in smaller limited release, and a couple other ones that are smaller and making their way through this great nation of ours, The Lobster and The Meddler. There's also going to be some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I am at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. Let's jump right into the news. The big one that it kind of touches me because I'm such a horror movie fan, and I'm such a fan of the original movie Halloween. The big news that hit this week is that John Carpenter has joined the Halloween reboot, sequel, remake, whatever it's turning into. He has come on as producer. Now, a lot of people were really excited about that because John Carpenter pioneered Halloween. What was originally going to be the Babysitter Murders back in the late 70s, he gave it the Halloween moniker, set it during that time period, and it became a classic. And they've done, I think it's something like 10 movies, if you count all of them, because of course they did H2O, and then they did Halloween Resurrection, and then they did the remakes that were just plain awful with Rob Zombie back in, 2007 and 2009 for Halloween 2. Went completely off the rails, just grounded the franchise again, and we haven't had a new one since Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. And we've learned a lot from franchises since then, because that's when the Marvel movies really took off, and that's also when you were getting the bringing back of movies like Star Wars were starting to show up in the works, and they were trying to build cinematic universes. And same thing happened with the Friday the 13th series when it was brought back in 2009, and then they never made another sequel. One of the things they're doing is they're going back to low budget, which is a smart thing to do for a horror movie like this, because what made these movies successful is their extremely low budget. There's $1-2 million movies back in the 80s and even into the 90s. They were profitable even if they didn't make tons of money. These movies don't need to have $100 million opening weekends. They just need to make like $10 million on that weekend, and then they'll be profitable. So bringing in something like Blumhouse is a good idea. Although I am still extremely skeptical of this, and this is why. John Carpenter's presence in a film does not necessarily mean anything anymore. He was a fantastic director in the 70s and the 80s. That was his heyday. He even did a couple cool things in the 90s. I mean, we're talking about, this is the guy who's biggest movies recently were stuff like Ghosts of Mars and Vampires. These were terrible films. He did The Ward, which kind of brought him back a little bit to some respectability, but even then, that wasn't that great of a film. Also, you got to remember that John Carpenter's the guy who helped produce The Fog remake, which was a remake of his own movie. He didn't direct it, but he produced it, and that thing was terrible. So just because he's on board does not mean it's going to be any good. He's clearly lost a bit of his flair as a classic horror director. The rumor is Mike Flanagan, who did Oculus, who's best known for that, might be coming on to direct. And that's actually more exciting to me than John Carpenter. And while I haven't liked everything that Mike Flanagan has done, he at least understands horror movies and has his arms wrist deep into horror movies today. Another piece of news, and this just kind of set me on edge, is this isn't even really news. I hate when this stuff gets reported as news, because it's not. Gillian Anderson, apparently from the X-Files, we all know her, but she's come out and said that she wants to be the next James Bond. I am so tired of news stories about this actor or actress saying, I'd love to play this role. Well, who wouldn't? Kevin Carr wants to play James Bond. Headline, Kevin Carr wants to play James Bond. Kevin Carr wants to be the next Iron Man. You need a bigger suit. I'm not just taller than Robert Downey Jr., but I have a little more girth. But, I mean, anybody can come out and say, I want to be the next whatever. And it's really funny when it's somebody like Gillian Anderson, who really doesn't, I mean, outside of X-Files, no one really cares about her. I mean, she's done some other stuff, sure. But this isn't news. This is the worst form of fan service. And it's doomed to fail if they do that on just because some actor wants it. And Hollywood needs to stop listening to the internet too much when it makes these movies, because sometimes they do them and they try to do the fan service too much. And what ends up happening is either they get something that the mainstream is not going to care about. Ghostbusters is a great example. They were listening to the internet demanding a Ghostbusters 3. People forget Ghostbusters 2 wasn't very good. Which, by the way, when I went and saw movies this week, I was sitting in front of a couple ladies and the Ghostbusters trailer played. They were basically commenting on each trailer when it was done. I don't care if they do that. That's not talking. I don't count that as talking during a movie, by the way. That's what trailers are for. They're to build excitement and say, do you want to see it? And if you see enough movies, you've seen these a billion times anyways. So at the end of the Ghostbusters trailer, plays out, one of them turns the other and goes, I really don't know about that one still. And I'm like, well, clearly they hate women. And clearly they're butthurt. Because that's the only reason you can be skeptical of the new Ghostbusters movie, is that you're butthurt and you hate women. Because there's no chance that you could have had any sort of opinion or just said that trailer didn't do it for me. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to jump into is Sausage Party. I don't know if I want to jump into a Sausage Party, but Sausage Party is coming out on August 12th.
Oh, yes, I'm the first to enter eternity.
Oh, potato, way to go, buddy!
The pipes are coming. Oh, Jesus, me eyes! Oh, gummy skin! She's peeling me
what
skin!
The...
I like my
mommy! They're eating children!
Now, just because this is an animated movie does not mean that it's for kids. And this has been a thing that has been so hard for some people to get over the years. Maybe in this post Family Guy world where those are wildly inappropriate for kids. And so sort of adult cartoons have had a bit of a renaissance recently. And this is essentially what you're getting with Sausage Party, although this is done by James Franco and Seth Rogen and the group that did movies like Pineapple Express and This Is the End. I think it looks funny. The only thing I hope is that it's not just using the platform of an animated movie to sort of just break the conventions. If the entire film is just based on these pieces of food making dirty jokes, that'll get old fast. There's got to be something more to it, even though it's like only 80 minutes. But still, it looks funny, and I'm waiting for the news story where people said, well, it was an animated film, so I took my kids. Did you not notice it's rated R? I didn't look. The other one I want to hit really quick is Beauty and the Beast, which opens on March 17th.
Look, a girl.
Yes, I can see it's a girl, you fool.
What if she is the one?
Hello?
Not much to this trailer. It's just a teaser, really. And this is the latest in Disney's live-action adaptations of their big animated films. Obviously, the most recent one, The Jungle Book, is just tearing up the box office. Some have been better than others, and some have been more successful than others. Cinderella was perfectly fine, but I honestly don't remember much about it. And Maleficent was ill-conceived at a certain point, kind of trying to tell from the bad girl's point of view, but they really ruined some things in Maleficent. And of course, you have Alice in Wonderland, which of course spawned the sequel we're going to be talking about this week. Beauty and the Beast looks okay. I mean, I just hope it doesn't feel just like a reshoot. I loved Beauty and the Beast, the original Beauty and the Beast from 1991, was one of my favorite of the new animated Disney movies. And it's got a lot to live up to. I just hope it's not going through the motions, which I kind of felt Cinderella was. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about X-Men Apocalypse and the Ones Below. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the movie reviews. Let's hit the big one, or at least one of the big ones, that's going to be hitting Memorial Day weekend. X-Men Apocalypse. The team of Charles Xavier's mutants face off against an all-powerful ancient mutant that could end the human race.
Some call him Apocalypse.
He was some kind of god. For thousands of years, he's been amassing mutants to take their powers. He always had four followers.
Like the four horsemen.
Eric, don't join them.
Whatever it is you think you saw in me, I buried it with my family.
Together, we will cleanse the earth.
I've never felt power like this before.
This is the technically the 10th X-Men movie in this series. It started, actually, people forget, this series is actually what started the big superhero revolution to the modern superhero movie. A lot of people like to think that, like, Iron Man did. And Iron Man certainly started the extended universe platform. And some people will point to Spider-Man, which came out in 2002, because that was such a huge hit. But none of this would have been possible if X-Men back in 2000 by Bryan Singer hadn't have been a big hit. Before that, there were superhero movies that were very different. It brought the superhero movie into a bigger world. If you talk like sort of like milestones, yes, Spider-Man was a milestone. It made $100 million its opening weekend, first film to ever do that. And The Dark Knight was a milestone, and Iron Man was a milestone, and Avengers were a milestone. X-Men in 2000 was a real milestone, as much as Batman from 1989 was, or Superman from 1978 was. This series has great pedigree to it because it got serious actors starring in the roles. I mean, you had Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. These were Shakespearean actors. So there's only six of the ones with all the X-Men, or essentially the ensemble group. There are three Wolverine movies knocked around and Deadpool. But this is a really good series. It's not the best of the series. X-Men has had its ups and downs, and bringing in a new cast back in 2010, I think, was when they did X-Men First Class. That really breathed new life into the series. And now they've got Days of Future Past, which was the sequel, which brought back Bryan Singer to direct. So this is his fourth X-Men movie out of the six. And it's probably his weakest of the four that he's done. And part of the problem is, if you compare how this one begins, it begins in this lavish Egyptian ancient world, and it looks like Gods of Egypt, which I kind of liked on my own, but it's a far cry from the opening of either X-Men First Class, which he didn't direct, or the original X-Men, which was a much more subtle display of mutant powers. So he does get carried away, and the CGI is a bit much in this movie. It really is overdone at times. And this brings back the cast from the younger generation of the X-Men, back from First Class, which kind of rebooted it. You've got Michael Fassbender as Magneto. You've got Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy. You've got Jennifer Lawrence playing Mystique. So it's the younger cast, which kind of is still fun to watch, and they're unformed. Even though this takes place in the 80s, Days of Future Past took place in the 70s, and X-Men First Class took place in the 60s during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they kind of ignore the fact that nobody ages. They make one comment about Rose Byrne's character, who should be pushing 50. The character should be pushing 50 now. Because she was, you know, what, mid-20s? At the youngest, mid-20s, late-20s in the 60s. So she'd be at least in her late 40s. But they're like, oh, it doesn't look like she's aged today. You accept it. It's a movie. But this is fun to watch. It's got the spectacle. It's a little overcrowded. They have a lot of mutants in this movie. And some of them are really lame. you know, Storm's always been kind of the lamest X-Men, and they give her a little more to do, and she's actually a little cooler in this one, the younger version of Storm. But Olivia Munn plays, I don't even know what her name is, but she's just basically a mutant with a lightsaber, essentially, that can turn into a whip. And they've got Angel, he flies, and he's good at fighting. I mean, that's really, these are not the best X-Men powers that you've seen, but that's okay, they work as a team. And it's fun to watch. Like I said, it's not the best one out there. And I know people who are diehard comic book fans are going to be critical of this or that, but that's not why they make these movies. They don't make them for the fans. They make them to make big money. You can't rely on a comic book movie that you put $200 million into to only do well with the fans. But more so than anything else, I was thinking when I left the theater, even if you're not a huge fan of this movie, 2016 is kind of unique. When have you ever, in the history of cinema, been able to go to a multiplex and in a single afternoon without leaving the building, see movies that feature Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, Tony Stark as Iron Man, The Avengers, Spider-Man, The X-Men, and you even get a little dab of Wolverine in this? The only thing we're missing right now is the Hulk for just this massive superhero smackdown. This is the first time you can spend an afternoon with all of these characters and never leave the theater. That's kind of groundbreaking. And say what you want to about Batman versus Superman, and say what you want to about this is how it stands up to the other X-Men movies. This is a great year for superhero movies simply because everyone gets their due. Ultimately, X-Men Apocalypse isn't as good as the others, but still, I had fun watching it. It runs a bit long with some lame mutant powers. But overall, I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with The Ones Below. This is a smaller movie, a British film. A couple moves into a new flat only to discover their downstairs neighbors blame them for a personal tragedy and end up fixating on their newborn baby.
Are you happy?
What do you say?
We have new neighbors, by the way.
They're a couple.
Hi.
Hi.
You must have just arrived.
Yeah, last night.
How long have you been together?
Just over 10 years.
Why aren't your children already?
The truth is, we weren't sure we wanted a child. I've always known I wanted a child. I don't know what's wrong with me.
We're leaving.
Are you sure you're okay?
I'm fine.
Stay away from my wife!
This is one of those home thrillers. The story is about this woman. She's pregnant, and then, of course, she gives birth to the baby, and it plays off of a lot of the issues that a young parent can face. Not just a young mother, but I took care of my kids. I'm a stay-at-home dad. And I know what it's like to have to take care of a baby all day until somebody comes home from work. It can be a challenge, and it's not for everybody, and there's a lot of stress at times, especially if the baby doesn't settle. So I understand where a lot of these parent thrillers mine their emotion from. Now, if you've never had kids, a lot of this movie is going to be lost on you. You can sort of, I guess that'd be stressful. But you know what it's like when you're dealing with another human being all day and you can't even carry on a conversation with it. It's a little bit odd and it puts you in a weird state of mind. So they capture that. They do a really good job. This movie plays off of previous films like it. So stuff like Rosemary's Baby, which is very psychologically twisted at times, or more specifically, The Hand That Rocks a Cradle. There's a lot to this movie that really, dare I say, rips off Hand That Rocks a Cradle. But while this does kind of stretch at times and it's not as meticulously put together as it thinks it is, it works as a sort of a throwaway thriller. I enjoyed it for what it was, and I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Alice Through the Looking Glass and The Lobster.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing through the movie reviews. Let's hit the other huge movie, and that's Alice Through the Looking Glass. Alice returns to Underland to find the Mad Hatter and restore absurd balance there.
Friends cannot be neglected. Hurry.
What's the matter?
The Hatter's the matter.
Hatter is my truest friend. If he's in need, I will help him.
It will be a race against time.
He is not someone you want as your enemy.
Time is a he.
Underland. Your time is up.
This stuck us all at 1 minute of tea time.
Tea time forever!
The first live-action Alice in Wonderland that came out back in 2010 is kind of this weird little anomaly in films. It was directed by Tim Burton, and it did insanely well. I mean, unprecedentedly well. Sometimes you have movies like Star Wars, when the new Star Wars came out at Christmas. They were saying, oh, it's going to be over $200 million opening weekend. And they were totally right on the money. It was $250 million. Or when they had Captain America Civil War, or Batman versus Superman, they're like, oh, it's going to be in over $150 million, pushing $200 million maybe. And it came in right around that. But then sometimes you have movies that people are predicting big weekends or to do well, and no one sees the wild success coming. Movies like the first Avengers. Now it's known as one of the biggest movies of all time, but back then, nobody was expecting that to do as well as it did opening weekend. I mean, even movies like Avatar, when that came out, it did really well opening weekend, but Avatar made its money with its legs. It was like a solid month or two of weekends, you know, 70, 50, 30, $40 million just every single weekend, just cranking out the cash. And no one saw the Avengers coming as big as it was. No one saw Jurassic World last year coming as big as it was because everyone was focused on Age of Ultron, which didn't make that $200 million number. Alice in Wonderland was kind of like that. It was the first big 3D movie that came out after Avatar, and it came out long enough after Avatar that Avatar had played through and it was okay to lose some theaters and some screens, and then they put this next one in, and it was such a fad at the time that it was a massive over $100 million weekend. It made over $1 billion, and I don't think anyone was expecting that. It did extremely well, and it kind of saddled Tim Burton with something to live up to for the next couple movies, which he didn't. Stuff like Dark Shadows never were massive movies for him. And of course, it made so much money, they decided to do a sequel. I think they're a little late to the party with a sequel. It's not directed by Tim Burton, but it has the same production design. It looks the same. The problem is, it's always a challenge to do an Alice in Wonderland movie. And the reason is, if you go back and read original Lewis Carroll stories, or even if you go see the movie from the 50s, the animated film, which one of the triumphs of that movie is that it embraces the nonsense. Because if you go back and you read those books, they're nonsense. They're just tales in nonsense. Lewis Carroll was a mathematician who was tired of order, so he wrote a series of stories that had no order to them whatsoever. It's just bizarre, whimsical vignettes is kind of what those original stories are. And if you go watch the original animated Alice in Wonderland, it totally embraces that. There's no follow-through plot aside from Alice trying to get home. I mean, it's not like The Wizard of Oz, which I always looked at Alice in Wonderland as Disney's Wizard of Oz, but it wasn't even like, I mean, Wizard of Oz has a clear-cut villain and there's a story and a narrative. The Alice in Wonderland, it's just her, well, curiouser and curiouser. And there's a charm to that and something innovative about that. That's why they've always been a challenge to bring to the screen, because you need a story for people to go to a movie. And they kind of shoehorn a story into that first one that Tim Burton did. And this one, they try even harder. But the problem is then they add a story that's essentially about time travel. And one of the challenges with the time travel movie is you have to fit into all these rules. Time travel works by rules. Now, we experience time in pretty much the same linear fashion as everybody else does. So we know how time works. And so mostly a time travel movie needs to explain how it can work in our very limited, dumb consciousness as creatures stuck moving forward in one dimension. Well, in Alice Through the Looking Glass, it's trying to apply these time conventions and these time rules to a story that exists in utter nonsense. And it just doesn't quite work. It feels real strained. And it's sort of like, you remember when you'd have to put bunny ears on your TV and you'd have to get reception, and if they broke, then you tape them and you maybe put some aluminum foil, and you end up having this weird contraption that barely holds it together. And if a stiff breeze comes through the room, it'll knock the bunny ears completely off and you'll lose your reception. That's essentially the plot structure of Alice Through the Looking Glass. It tries to give too much to it. It gives too much character development. I don't want to know why the Hatter's mad. I don't want to know why the evil Red Queen is so evil, but they tried to do that. They give it a backstory. They give everybody a backstory and an origin. And that kind of works against the movie because it just exists in its absurdity and silliness, but you're giving too much pragmatic work to it, and it takes away some of its magic. If you're a huge fan of the production design and the look of the first one, you're going to get more of the same. But ultimately, I just found it somewhat disappointing. So I'm going to have to say Alice Through the Looking Glass kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Lobster. In an alternate world, a man has to visit a rehab clinic when he breaks up with his lover, given a limited time to get in a new relationship or be turned into an animal.
Have you ever been on your own before?
No, never.
Your last relationship lasted how many years?
Around 12.
And the dog?
My brother. He was here a couple of years ago, but he didn't make it.
Did you read the leaflet?
Yes, I did.
As you understand from your brother's experience,
if you fail to fall in love with someone during your stay here, you'll turn into an animal. As an animal, you'll have a second chance to find a companion. Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
A lobster is an excellent choice.
This is a fascinating film because it's so grounded in an apparent reality that is completely unreal. I saw this in a daytime screening. They screen movies during the day for the press, and sometimes they have public screenings in the evening, where anybody who gets a ticket can come. It's not uncommon for the press screenings. I'm oftentimes running late because I've got commitments at home I'm dealing with. Got to get kids to school. I got work I got to get done. I want to get one little thing done before I go see a movie. And I don't have to be there early because there's plenty of seats, because you know you have maybe like 5 people at the screening. So it's not uncommon for me to just be scrambling, running late, getting in the parking garage, dealing with traffic, and maybe I come in a minute or two late. And I've come in and missed like that first scene, or just the very opening of a film, and usually I can get by without seeing that. And it's not all the time, but it happens from time to time. Well, for some reason, I was able to be completely on time for The Lobster. But I'm so conditioned to that, so when I saw the movie, I'm like, did I miss something at the beginning? Because I didn't even know it was in this sort of alternate universe, that this was real. They talk about them saying, if you don't find a mate, you're going to have to be turned into an animal. And I'm like, did they explain this at some point? No, you just dropped into this movie at the beginning. And I saw it from the first frame on. I didn't miss a second. But I felt like I was kind of behind, because it was such a bizarre framework. Now, it kind of exists in two parts. And the first part's stronger than the second part, because in the second part, it gets out of the camp to sort of like these wayward rebels who follow a very similar structured life, only it's the antithesis of what goes on in the camp. There's a lot that it's saying, and I don't know if I'm smart enough to get everything it's saying. But I will say that this is a fascinatingly fun movie. Better in the beginning than it is at the end. It does kind of lose some steam. And there's one part, and I'm not going to say what it is because it's such a spoilery thing near the end, that it lost me a bit because they needed something to happen. And so it just happened. And I'm like, well, that didn't quite work. So it maybe could have baked a little longer, but it's still a neat movie. If you want something different, check out The Lobster. The Lobster rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break and make some money. And then when I come back, I'm going to be talking about a review of The Meddler, the box office, and the home cinema roundup.
a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse, Kevin Carr's new novelettes Not the End and Gobble offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are finishing up the show with one more film review, and that is The Meddler. Susan Sarandon plays an overbearing mother to Rose Byrne, trying to put her life back on track after recently becoming a widow.
You're not bringing the mail?
Jesus! Mom, you have to ring the doorbell.
But I've got the key.
How do you feel since your husband died?
There are a lot of hours in the day, and so sometimes I call Lori.
I brought you bagels.
You should have called.
I did,
but I didn't answer.
I think we should get you a hobby.
Or maybe you could be my hobby.
Who are you texting?
You need to have sex with someone and you can't be here for it.
I still need a ride to the airport.
What's funny about acting choices and character performances, you sometimes get movies that are somewhat similar. And this movie reminds me a bit of Hello, My Name is Doris. That's the movie with Sally Field and came out a couple months ago, which was a charming film, a wonderful performance by Sally Field. And I feel that this is sort of Susan Sarandon's version of that. Now, the character is very different. In Hello, My Name is Doris, she's been single all her life. And this is, of course, about a woman who's newly single after being widowed. But it's a piece about an older actress who probably would have done better if they would have brought these out later in the year. The Meddler and Hello, My Name is Doris are not necessarily award bait films because they're not dealing with an issue. It's not like Grandma from last year, which was Lily Tomlin playing an old lesbian dealing with her granddaughter trying to get her an abortion. I mean, that's just rife with social issues. These are just character studies of older women. And for all the talk of there aren't great roles out there for actresses, especially older actresses, both these movies show that there are good roles for them. Now, they're not going to make $500 million, but they certainly are good roles. And Susan Sarandon, who I'm like blow hot and cold with her. I mean, say what you want to about her and her politics outside of the movies. As an actress, sometimes I think she does a great job. I include the original Rocky Horror Picture Show in there as one of her great acting performances. But I've also seen her do well in some movies, but I've never been a huge fan of hers. But boy, she really does a great job in this film. She kind of just becomes this batty old woman who is trying to fill her days after her husband dies and is just basically overbearing. And it's very clear that there's a lot of autobiographical stuff in here because the main character that she focuses on, which is Rose Byrne, her daughter, plays a television writer. So the woman who wrote this, you can tell she's sort of venting her spleen probably about her mom, and that's okay. You can do therapy via screenplay. That works. And it doesn't revel in the industry. I've never been a big fan of movies that are about like the movies in general because it's sort of a depressing world, and it's more fun to just look at that from afar. I rather see movies about average people, and really, Susan Sarandon's character is an average person. And she's very charming in it. She's sweet. I thought she really becomes a real character in that the movie is not constructed in a way to just make her break down. In somebody else's hands, this movie would be nothing but us waiting for this character to just fall apart or to do something really horrible, have the breakdown moment and disappoint a lot of people. She follows through with the stuff she does in the movie, but you can tell she has underlying issues and we don't see those issues get resolved, but we don't need to. And that's kind of what I liked about the real world applications of this film. Plus, it has some very nice performances. I mean, Rose Byrne is kind of not in it all that much. It's mostly about Susan Sarandon's character. And at a time, she goes completely away from her daughter, which is kind of cool because while it's the meddler, it's her meddling in other people's lives as well. But you've got some great performances. You've got J.K. Simmons playing a would-be boyfriend of Susan Sarandon's character, and he pretty much channels Sam Elliott in this movie, which is odd because Sam Elliott starred in that Grandma movie last year with Lily Tomlin. This isn't out to make any big awards push. This is out to just tell a story about a woman who is overbearing on her daughter, and it's charming and it's sweet. And I found myself enjoying it. It's not really my kind of movie. It's really more for the daughter to take her mom to, but it works for what it is. So I'm going to have to say that The Meddler kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Winners last week, I had said that Captain America was going to win again. It did not. It did not make the $40 million to win. Angry Birds did win, but Angry Birds came in under that $40 million with $38 million. Captain America came in with $33. And then Neighbors 2 did not do very well. Neighbors 2 did $22 million, just under that. And that's a far cry from what it made the first movie. The first movie's in the 40s. I mean, it made like half of what the first movie made. The Nice Guys made less, but I think they were expecting it to make 10 or 12 million, and it made 11. So that's right on expectations. Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, did not do well. And that's good because it's a crappy movie, and it's social engineering via movie that's completely misplaced, and there's nothing redeeming about Neighbors 2. Don't let other people tell you otherwise. Now, this week, it's going to probably be X-Men Apocalypse. I mean, we'll have to wait until Tuesday until we get the numbers for the full weekend in terms of the four-day. I think it's probably good for $85 million by the time the four-day is all wrapped up. It's not going to be as big as the other X-Men movies. It's kind of falling at the end of the superhero run for the spring because you already had Batman versus Superman and Civil War. So it is going to be competing against itself and the industry itself. I think Alice Through the Looking Glass, it's not going to make that $115 million that the first one did. I think there's just been too much time has passed and the novelty has worn off. But overall, X-Men's probably going to win. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Couple new releases on movies, and one of them is The Finest Hours, and that stars Chris Pine as a Coast Guard rescuer who does a daring rescue back in the 50s. A well-made movie, an inspirational, exciting movie, a little bit overdone with the special effects. And that's one of the problems, and this goes back to Alice in the Looking Glass and X-Men Apocalypse. Sometimes there's just so much special effects, you feel like you're watching a cartoon. And you get that a little bit with The Finest Hours because you don't really believe the boat's out there. And you see that with X-Men Apocalypse when they start in the lavish Egyptian past. It looks like a cartoon. The CGI just looks too perfect, and it doesn't have a real look to it. It looks cheap. And that's one of the biggest problems that you're seeing a lot in movies. Now, in The Finest Hour, I don't know if there's any way to shoot a lot of this practically, especially on the outside of the boat, but I do feel it loses a bit with the CGI. But overall, it's a good movie. It's worth seeing, and I enjoyed it. Other ones out this week, Zoolander 2 is out, which I enjoyed more than most people did. And Risen, which is an interesting take on biblical stories in which the resurrection of Christ is told from the point of view of a Roman centurion. How to Be Single is out, which I was not a big fan of. I mean, I'm not the target market for this, so, you know, let's be fair about that. It's made for the Facebook generation, where you plaster your social media status about your relationships, and the pictures you post are inspirational memes telling you how you need to be respected by people and to get toxic people out of your life. It's basically for people who want to continue to party into their 30s and not have a respectable job in life. And that's what some people do. I mean, the 30s are the new 20s now, and the 20s were the new teenage years. And then finally, Bad Influence is brought back with James Spader and Rob Lowe, a 1990 thriller from Shout Factory. So if you want to get your fix of Rob Lowe and James Spader in 1990 Well, Rob Lowe's held up over the years. James Spader's not so much. And then finally, one of the best ones out there, Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 2, Back from the Vault. Shout Factory has been releasing these every 6 months or so for several years, and they're up to like Volume 34 or something like that. But they're going back and releasing some of the old box sets that have four movies to them. And this one, you've got Pod People, Cave Dwellers, and Angel's Revenge, which are three movies. Pod People and Cave Dwellers come from the third season of Mystery Science Theater. Angel's Revenge it has Mike as the host, and that comes from the third season. And then they have Shorts Volume 1, so a bunch of the shorts kind of crammed together in its own disc. Pod People, to me, holds a special place in my heart because it was the first MST I'd ever seen. I swerved into it on Thanksgiving Day back in like 1991. My sister and I fell in love with it immediately. Everyone wanted to watch football, but we wrestled control of the remote. We watched that and Side Hackers. Loved this stuff. That is what introduced me to MST3K, and that is what has made it part of my favorite set, because it has the original Pod People to it. That's it for this week. I need to take off. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Me Before You, Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stoppin', and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. Have a happy Memorial Day, and until we talk again, have a fat time at the movies.